Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the picture?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movie.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
And we have a very special bonus episode for you this week, as we had the opportunity to sit down with May Pang and talk to her about her brand new film, The Lost Weekend, A Love Story. The documentary is released in cinemas in North America this week and comes out in the UK and Ireland in June. We'll do a full episode on the film to coincide with that release, but we have already seen it and it's very interesting. Really interesting, right?
It's very interesting, yeah. I think it might ruffle the old feather.
So we will do a deep dive into the film for the UK release, but until then, please enjoy this interview with May Pang. Hello, May. Thanks for coming to our podcast and congratulations on the film.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You're one of the few that have seen it so far.
Really? Is that right? Yeah. It's a pleasure to obviously be able to talk to you about it at all. One of the things we wanted to ask you first off was, there's a tagline for the film on the poster which says that it is a love story that took 50 years to tell. So how does it feel for you now to finally be able to tell that story and to have that story reach an audience?
You know, it's almost surreal for me because it's been so long. You know, people kept saying, oh, I can't believe that actually happened. You know, I've heard all that stuff before. And finally putting it out is really cathartic in lots of ways. You know, it gives me that breathing room all of a sudden. I said, oh God. And then a lot of my friends who had been around me were so thrilled that I finally got a chance to tell the story. I've for years have stayed away from it only because I just didn't feel it was the right time. I just didn't feel it. And somewhere about 5-6 years ago, I just said, you know what? It's time. It's time. Because I started to see my own story being told by other people that were not correct. And guess what? You want to be the one to tell the story. They weren't there. I was, you know.
So it was you that instigated the making of the film in the first place. And that was a question I had. So yeah. How did that come about? How did you find the right filmmaker to then translate your story to screen?
Well, years ago, I was contacted by Eve Brandstein, who is one of the, this film is so unusual, has three co-producer directors. And Eve Brandstein was the first, and she, we became friends. She wanted to do a film about me way back when in the 90s, actually, on my book. And I said, no, I didn't want to do it. So, but we remained friends. And over the years, she would come back and forth from LA to New York. And this time in New York, we decided to have dinner. And And I said, what are you doing now? And she says, oh, I'm working on women's plays. I direct them. And I said, oh, that's great. She goes, I also work on documentaries. And just at that split moment, didn't even think. I turned around. And I said, that's what I want to do. And she said, what do you mean? I said, I want to make a documentary. It's time. I want to do it. She goes, are you sure? I said, yeah, now I want to do documentary. I said, but it'd be on my life rights, not on my, you know, not on the book. Because, you know, the book, you're stuck where it is. I want it a little bit more, you know, wide open to it. And so she then contacted Richard Kaufman, who makes films, you know, and different things and trailers. And then he said, wait a minute, hold on, I'm going to get somebody else. This guy, Stuart Samuels, who is an archivist. And he was the one that was working on that Ron Howard film, The 8 Days a Week, you know, the Beatles touring years. And he was an associate producer on that. And he and Richard goes, have you ever heard of May Pang? Because that's not Richard's forte, the music business. So he said, of course I have, you know, and he goes, let's talk to her. And that's how it began, like, you know, 6 years ago, something like that. So that's, yeah, it's not an overnight thing. It has taken this long. And I kept my hands off of the filming of it. I told him I did not want to. Yeah, I know people would say, you end up micromanaging and it doesn't come off well. I've seen it on other people's films. You don't want to be doing, I don't like the way my hair looks. And then you start saying, I'm not doing this, you know, and as you were just saying, or I don't think I look great and I don't think this is good. And I just didn't want to do that. I wanted more of an unbiased look at this than coming from me. So everything was done, you know.
But presumably there was a involvement on your part to provide some of the unreleased materials that make their way into the film.
Yes. I mean, they asked me what did I have, and obviously I provided things for them. You know, that's as much, but you know, when it came to the shooting, putting the storyline together, they would come back to me to be sure it was correct, all that. And they shaped the whole film for me. And then, but if obviously if I didn't like something, I would then say something if it was really wrong or not, it was not, you know, a thing that fitted with the storyline, then I'd say, yeah, but it was practically zip on that one, you know? So there wasn't a whole lot of argument from me on any level. So that was always good. The only time I actually saw the film in one sequence was just before I did the narrative to it. When you hear my voice, I had not seen the film. So I only saw it in bits and pieces at that moment. And I had no idea because they needed my voice for certain scenes. And then when we were finally doing the final, they said, I guess we have to show you the film. I said, I guess so, you know, and they did. so that I could have some understanding what I'm saying, you know, with the narrative, and but they were great, and so we did that.
It's an interesting approach, sort of doing it that way around, especially when it's your story. It's very much your story, this film, and so I'd sort of presumed that the narration was maybe one of the first things to happen because it kind of informs the way the film moves along. But no, it just plugged it in at the end, basically.
Right. No. Well, the whole thing is that I've been interviewed by them. And then they shape the story. But, you know, then when they're shooting it, you need the bits and pieces to, you know, my voice to go over some of the lines. And that was like, you know, a draft on that whole level until the final bit when they finally says, okay, now we have the film intact, as it were, you know, for the hour and a half. And I got to see it, you know, now straight through and now be able to tell the story with a little more understanding what I was reading. You know, I'd be saying, well, where is this line from? You know, so it was good.
that last scene as well is such a lovely grace note to end the film on.
Yes,
with
thank you
and Julian. And I wondered what his thoughts were when he was first approached, presumably by yourself, to be included in the movie.
Yes, I did. I did contact him and I asked him. And there was no hesitation. He said, of course I do it. It was something that, you know, I'm always hesitant to ask people to do anything, you know, But I was very, you know, I was very close to his mother, and he was a big part of my time with John. So that is definitely, you know, one of those things. And I was very thrilled that he said yes.
There's a lovely moments in the film. It really pays off, I think. It's nice to have that inclusion in there. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the very first scene in the film is you on the chat show being asked about, I guess, a criticism that you're being asked to address at the time, which was, do you think that members of the public might think you're just trying to capitalize on John Lennon's fame? And you answer very gracefully at that time saying that you just want to be able to tell your story. That felt like it was intentionally preempting this film in its entirety. Do you think that was the case?
You know, it probably, you know, it over the years, that's the only thing anybody ever talks about. It's you're doing it for the money. I don't think I've ever seen, you know, an interviewer to anyone in that type of situation where I was, they go, are you sure you're not doing it for the money? And it's always that type of thing that comes up. And if it was, boy, I don't know. I lost out somewhere because I didn't see anything over the years. I've been working all these years, you know, and then I don't know. I didn't find that pot of gold at the end, you know, of the rainbow. But it is to tell the story. It is to tell my side because I didn't have the quote the money as other people would, and they could have the narrative. They can change whatever they want. They have the party line. I didn't have that. So I can only rely on the truth of what actually happened back then. And that's why I went out there. Because I know this is one of the puzzle pieces of John's life that everybody was interested in. I mean, I can't tell you how many fans over the years have reached out and said, oh, when are you going to tell the story? When can we see something? Is it going to be on television? Or is it going to be on film or whatever? And I've just said no. And now it was just time. It's this generation that would understand more on film than it is reading a book or anything else. So I took the chance now. And it is this year, 50 years. How weird is that?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, and I started. Who would have known that it was going to take me now to really say, hey, it is 50 years. You know, and everybody who wrote, you know, who would say to me, oh, I know your story. And I said, you do? They said, I've read everything about it. Now, they don't know if it's true. But again, it's that line these days, you know, if you say it often enough that the lies become the truth. And I think we've all seen that. And then you say, but that's not the truth. So it was my turn. And I'm the one telling it, not somebody else telling it to me. You know,
it's really interesting as well, because I think as obviously big fans of the Beatles ourselves, I think that is something that each of the Beatles themselves were always very conscious of and saying a lot themselves. They always wanted to be in control of their own narrative. So it obviously makes sense that by extension, you'd feel the same way. How did you feel any sense of importance then when you were doing this film, that you were plugging the gaps in the knowledge that those fans have been asking you for over the years? You know, and I realize it's a very personal story for you, but did you feel like almost like there was a responsibility there, or how much of that might have informed the shaping of the film?
That was a lot, because it is, you know, when you see the misinformation that goes out there and all the stuff that goes out, and you're saying, that's not how it happened. You know, after a while you start saying it and you go, oh God, here we go again. That's not the truth. That's not the way it happened. So to me, this was an important storyline to finally get the truth out, through my eyes, through the way it happened to me, not to them. I mean, I've had more stories told by people and by other people saying, oh, I heard from so-and-so and they told me how they were at this thing with you. And I'm going, who is that? I don't know them. You know, so this has happened just, you know, more and more. So, it was time to just, you know, put the brakes on and say, okay, it's time to tell the truth and you know, tell the story out.
Yeah, it does feel a lot like it's sort of redressing the balance in terms of you having been sort of sidelined in terms of your significance to John and that wider story. Do you have any feelings about how sort of women have been represented in the telling of the Beatles story in general?
You know, everybody has their, I don't know what their household was like. I know my household was just slightly different, even from the one that John had, you know, with Yoko and Cynthia. You know, we all had different households. So I cannot think what Ringo's was like with, you know, with Maureen, and then of course with Barbara and, you know, and everybody else he's gone out with, or Paul and his wives and George and, you know, what was going on there. I can only say that we all have our different stories and we all have our different viewpoints here. But I think when it came to, for me, and I can only talk about me, is what happened with me and John. But if people really look at everything, I know it was a weird time and it was like, oh, you know, Yoko sent me off. It wasn't exactly that. You know, it was because John actually pursued me in the end. And that was the reason that it changed, it pivoted, because whatever she was doing and she wanted, and I was like, I'm not having this. This is like ridiculous. And I was ready to think about maybe I should quit because I'm not wanting this, the situation. But it was John who came after me at the end. And it was he and his decision to go to Los Angeles for a break. Not to move there, but just to have a break from what was going on in New York, just so that we could have room to breathe and have a relaxation. And then later on, you know, all the different crazy people that showed up in our lives, you know, from Harry Nilsson to Phil Spector and, you know, and whatever was happening at that moment in time. And it was great to have Julian come visit for the first time in several years. So it was.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good.
It seems quite clear, especially now in this day and age, that you know the various Beatles estates are very protective of the Beatles' legacy and want to be careful about, I guess, anything straying from the narrative they want to present. I wondered whether or not you were aware of any resistance to the film being made and being released over your time working on it. Were you aware of there being any potential objections, or is that not?
That didn't happen with me. No, that didn't happen. No, I didn't have any, you know, anybody knocking on my door and saying, you can't do it. Everything was, it was just done. You know, and I was told, you know, by people too, he says, you know, you're allowed, since I'm a first person, I'm allowed to tell my story. This is not, I heard type of thing. So I'm the first person involved and everything, the storyline that we are talking about was involving me. So there's I think that's the difference than somebody, you know, who Joe Schmo saying, oh, you know, I was there. And you go, who are you? Again, I say that because it's happened to me so many times.
You mentioned Harry Nilsson, obviously the Hollywood vampires. I didn't realize until seeing the film that you were the only sober person at the table during those times. What was that like?
A bit strange. I was called by some of the, a couple of female, maybe one really, where they thought I was Miss Goody Two Shoes. Because I didn't drink, I didn't take drugs, I didn't partake in any of it. It's funny because being the youngest out of that group, I was also feeling I was the oldest in that group because I was managing everybody else's life. And it just felt like that. I know a lot of people. So when you see Coca-Cola pictures and you see Coca-Cola, the bottles in those days, not even cans, was the bottles. They're mine. That's what I was drinking. That was my choice of drink.
So you're the designated driver most of the time then.
Yeah. Oh, it was, you know, it was great when we were back in the States, when we were back in New York, and, you know, we had the car, we had this car, and we go out to visit. John was so thrilled at the fact that I would be the one driving. There's just the two of us. There wasn't, he didn't go for the limos and all that. I mean, he understood it, like if we're going to an opening, that's different. But, you know, on the daily basis, he'd rather not deal with that, you know. And of course, I took him on a New York City bus ride one Saturday morning, and he was so shocked. And all these people are sitting on the bus, getting on the bus, and they see him. They're going, and you can hear the whispering. They're going, is that John? No, it can't be. Yes, no, I'm telling you, I think it is. And then John is sitting there going like this with his finger holding onto his face, and he's going, it's the nose. It's giving it away. It's the nose. And then somebody finally yelled out and said, hey, John, how are you doing? And he goes, fine. And he turned to me, it's time to get off the bus. And I, it's crazy.
I one of the great things about the film is when it presents those shots of you and John, and I think your trip to Vegas and your time after that, where there are just some really candid shots of him meeting members of public, like you say. And I always feel like in the Beatles documentaries, I'm never too sure what has been already released and what hasn't. But it feels like there are some moments there that just feel like they are sort of intimately captured moments that this film is presenting for the first time. Is that
true? A lot of people haven't seen those photos. They were from my, you know, they're my home photographs that, you know, John loved to let me take. He liked my eye when I would capture him. I mean, he was an easy subject, obviously, for me. But he never liked photographs taken by other photographers. He just felt uneasy. He says, I'm not happy. I look too fat. I look, you know, he was always making a comment. And, you know, he liked one photographer named David Garr, you know, who's no longer with us, but it was some beautiful black and whites. He goes, that man's crazy. I said, I know, because he would just be yelling, and he was an older man, and he was just, come on, John, you got to do this. And we're in the middle of the street, and he's like taking these photos, and he liked his photographs the best. You know, that wasn't from me, it was him. And then I've been very fortunate to be in a position to take photos that nobody else had captured, you know, the last good photo of John and Paul together, or the where I also took a photograph of John in mid-signature with the dissolution of the Beatles, the last photographs. Who would have thought? And people have asked me, did I not witness history? And I'm thinking, this was every day for me, and I didn't think about history. It was like, okay, you want me to take a photograph? Fine. And I would take it and I walk away. And so it wasn't about the history. It was more like, okay, he wants me to take photographs. Let me just do something here, you know?
They're just incredible in the film, though. They really bring to life the massive contribution you've made in documenting some of these really important parts of the cultural history that comes along with the Beatles.
You know, and I didn't think about that. Yeah, until, you know, when people start talking about it, and I said, oh, I guess I have, you know. But I'm glad I did. Let's put it that way.
It feels like not just John, but, you know, you've also been in rooms with Paul and Ringo and George. There's a bit in the film about George inviting you to the Dick Cavett show, which I hadn't realized. Did you have a sort of a friendship with George at the time?
Well, you know, it wasn't. I had met George a couple of times. In fact, he was in the offices before I worked for John and Yoko. I was at the office in New York. And he was, you know, I had met him then. He had brought his All Things Must Pass album to be, to be mastered in New York for the U.S. release. And he was, whenever he saw anybody in the halls or anything, he was just very kind, very sweet. And, you know, and I got, in a sense, I guess I got friendly with him. So he recognized me a couple of times during all this, you know, back then. I mean, he really was a very nice genuine person, and he was very happy that it was me that was with John. It was really, I, you know, didn't even think about that, but, you know, he actually said to John, he goes, "I'm just glad she's with you." And I was just taken aback by that. And because, you know, I'm surprised. I never think about somebody making a comment like that and thinking, oh, wow, okay. You know, and he even said that to John. He says, "Yeah, I'm glad she's with you." You know, and he's pointing with his finger. It's like this.
It's a nice comment, though, because actually that seems to be in sort of the film and also the books I've read. There's lots and lots of people who spent time with you and John in that period seem to observe in him that he felt very relaxed, just sort of very enjoying other people's company. Did it sort of seem that way to you, that they were
all the time
thinking, oh, this is nice, this is, yeah, it feels good, you know?
Our house was an open house. And I just will say that was my policy. You know, Paul and Linda showed up one day and we had no idea they even knew where we lived. Never mind back in the city. You know, John's answering the door and he goes, "You won't believe who's downstairs." And I said, "Who?" He goes, "Paul and Linda." And I said, "Okay." And so he says, "What should we do?" I said, "What do you mean, what should we do? He should come up. They should come up. They're your friends." He said, "Can you handle it?" And I said, "What do you mean? There's nothing to handle." So they came up and they were constant visitors to our place every time they were in New York. Mick Jagger was another one all the time that was at our house. So, you know, they would come up and, you know, and have a meal. You know, we had a very small, we did not live palatially. Like, you know, we didn't have the Dakota look. You know, we had this one little flat and, you know, it's maybe no bigger than 800 square feet. 900, which is very tiny. It's only a one bedroom. And what we did was we took our main room, the living room, we bought this bed, which I still have to this day. And we just used that as the sofa, our sleep in, our everything, and two little director's chair. And we used the bedroom. We bought a settee over there. And we let that be Julian's room when he would come. So that would be his. So he had a place to stay.
And did you, when you had those like, sort of frequent visits, and even, you know, Paul and Linda, were you able to continue a friendship with them even after your relationship with John ended?
Yeah, I did see them after. I saw Paul about 5 years ago, whatever it was, about there, 5 years, six years ago, when he came through town and he was playing at the Barclay Center. And I saw him there, went to say hello to him, hadn't seen him in a while. Obviously, I hadn't seen George. I saw him maybe once or twice. Saw him at a concert in England, and he was at the same concert. Maybe it was a Dylan concert. It was in London. I'm not sure. I can't remember. And Ringo, I kept seeing every so often, you know, over the years. But I hadn't seen any of them now in a number of years.
I wondered, at the moment it feels like we're on the wave of another resurgence of popularity in the Beatles, partly informed by the release of Get Back. I wondered if you have found time to see that yet, and if you did, what you made of it.
I just think that Get Back was good, you know, and you know, when you look at what it was like with Let It Be, and then you go to Get Back, I think putting it together, there's something in the middle. I don't, you know, it's one to the other. I think, you know, when you have two different things coming from the same time period, and they're big difference between the first one, which is very somber, to the second one, which is very happy, something's got to be in the middle somewhere. I don't know where, but, you know, it's got to be there. I just don't know. And I think for whatever, there's always the story to be told. I mean, there's, you know, it goes both ways. We did the pendulum swing, left to the right. We need the center. And I guess we could all figure it out.
You mentioned a lot, and obviously it's a key focus of the film, this idea of redressing the balance and correcting misconceptions about yourself and your relationship with John. What would you say the biggest misconception there is that still exists about either yourself and of John?
Oh, that Yoko, probably one was the biggest, was that John never saw Yoko. She called us anywhere up to 10, 15 times a day. We had seen her when we were in New York. We would see her. That the other myth was, you know, that John went back after the Elton John concert, you know, in Madison Square Garden. And it isn't true, because if you look at the timeline, we went to George's concert. We went down to Florida with Julian for, you know, for the Christmas holiday. And then we came back and we were about to buy a house out in, you know, in Montauk in New York. So there's a lot of misconceptions there. So there's more, I'm sure, but those are the things I could think of at this moment. Oh, yes, one big one. It was not a weekend, even though we call it the Lost Weekend. It is not a weekend.
I feel like that must have been bugging you for a long, long time.
Well, you know, you got to think about that. I'm sure, you know, I always tell people this, but you know, John loved you. Why would you have to tell people? And I said, well, let me put it this way. Does it bug me? Yes, because I don't want people to say that didn't happen. So if you don't stick up for yourself and you don't say it, who else is going to do it for you, right? So I always tell the story, like, if you created something and you were the one that did it, but somebody else takes the credit for it, how do you feel? And they said, well, I wouldn't like it. I said, well, there you go. It's the same idea. Somebody else has taken the credit for everything that I've done, or I wasn't there. So, you know, you want to be able to correct that for the history buffs, especially on the Beatles.
And I think the obviously it's longer than a weekend. I think in my mind it was always closer to a year, but obviously this film.
Oh, it's over a year. It was over a year.
Yes. Yeah. Closer to 18 months, it seems, to the film.
Yeah.
And also the film goes on to say that suggests that also that you were still keeping contact with John even after that period.
Yes, that's true. We saw each other in the last 5 years. Oh, absolutely.
And what was that relationship like at that point?
It was really tough, because we never reconciled in our situation. It was really left in a, even though it sounded like it ended, it wasn't really an end. And so, as I, you know, it's and of course now it ended because of the situation. So it's it was really tough. So we saw each other. I spoke to him in 1980. He called me from South Africa to say hello, and he said hello, and then it was, let's see how we can figure out how to see each other. I know that we never, it never finished. Our, you know, there was no closure for us.
That's something I really got the sense of towards the end of the film, because there's the bit where you're clearly a bit emotional about it, and I got the sense that you felt like you hadn't had closure on that relationship.
No, there definitely was not closure. It was tough, and that, you know, you take a deep breath and now you just have to go with it. And again, here we are 50 years later telling the story, and this is where it began 50 years ago.
Mm.
So you start with mind games and here we are, you know?
yeah. And I got the sense that even after all that time, and after then, you know, and then you married Tony Visconti, and you had two children. But even now, it's still it's quite raw. It seems to me, you know, those memories.
Because it's never there's no closure in this one, and there's no people are, you know, every day I'll hear Number 9 Dream, I'll hear my voice, I'll hear songs that, you know, so things that were written for me, or I hear little quips that happened during my time. A lot of people don't realize so much in that time frame that John and I were together. We hung out with people. We were in recording studios. And when they read about it, that period of time was with me. And it's never forgotten. That's such a big moment.
And presumably every Christmas as well.
Oh, yeah.
every single goes without saying. Listen, thank you so much for giving us your time to come on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and congratulations again on the film. Good luck with its release.
Oh, thank you. And I know it's going to be somewhere in June for everybody in the UK, because I keep getting all the, when is it going to come here? You know, so I keep getting it from the fans. soon, just a little longer for you guys, you know. Thank you.
We're the lucky ones. We're ahead of the curve.
You are. Yeah. Absolutely. The head of the curve. It's true. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you, May.
So there we go. That was a nice talking to May, wasn't it?
I think it was. I think we made a new friend.
Yes, new Beatles friend. We've added her to a contact list and we have her phone number forever now. So I hope you enjoyed that special episode and the interview with May. Just a quick note, if you like what you heard today and you actually want to go back and listen to some of our other episodes that we've recorded in the past, we've covered all of the major Beatles films releases. We've got episodes on Backbeat, Yesterday, Nowhere Boy, as well as two-parters on the actual official Beatles films themselves, like Help and Magical Mystery Tour. Otherwise, please feel free to leave us a review or a five-star rating on your podcast listening platform of choice. And feel free to follow us on social media. We are at Beatles Films Pod on all of the usual places. Until next time, we will see you again for another episode next week. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.